This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Every so often, maybe once a week, the cartoonist Liana Fink leaves the house early and buys a ticket for the Long Island Railroad. That's a commuter line that goes out of New York, but Liana's not actually commuting. She's not going anywhere. She just likes riding the train. She likes the hubbub. She likes to be around people without getting sucked into conversation.
I like to come up with New Yorker cartoons on the train. I can't stand when people talk to me when I'm working, but I love when they talk to each other.
A ride to exactly nowhere with Liana Fink later this hour. But we're going to start with a ride of a very different kind, bracing and exciting for some and, frankly, terrifying for others. The first 100 days of the Trump administration. Donald Trump campaigned to bring change to the way things are done in Washington, and he's brought it, unquestionably. And with his team dealing in alternative facts or falsehoods or lies, call it what you will, our job of telling you the truth, the job of journalists, as best we can figure out, is harder than it's ever been. Recently, there was more news about the infamous Russian dossier, the unverified documents alleging salacious and very damning activities by the man who's now president. And nearly all of what we know about the dossier came from its publication online in BuzzFeed. Now, BuzzFeed, if you're not familiar with it, is a website that mixes a lot of things, quizzes, videos, listicles, all kinds of clickbait, alongside some very serious and very thorough reporting. Ben Smith is the editor-in-chief, and he made the controversial decision to publish the entire dossier on BuzzFeed with a disclaimer telling you, the reader, to make up your own mind whether to believe it or not. Ben, I thought what we would do is, before we get into a back and forth about whether it was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do to publish this dossier, I want to know the narrative of what happened. We hear here and there that this dossier was floating around in Washington and elsewhere long before the election.
So, I mean, as you say, this dossier had been in various versions. And if you look at it, it's dated. There are monthly updates to it. We learned after we published it, lots of people popped up and said, oh, I had a copy, too. It was in fairly wide circulation and had been pitched both to journalists and to the FBI over the late summer.
By whom?
So we don't have original reporting on this. It's been reported that it was commissioned by a... So the sort of unique, very high-powered opposition research is sometimes the term for it, shopped from a retired British spy.
Well, because it's Christopher Steele. I mean,
it's been reported that it was a former MI6 agent. Actually, I think the guy who ran the Russia desk at MI6, so not a random person at all, like meaning one of the best informed Western intelligence figures on Russia. Period.
And opposition research, meaning the political parties involved, the Democratic Party having its opposition research, Republicans having its, at some remove sometime.
Well, actually, I don't think it's been reported who paid for it.
So go on.
Nobody shopped it to me. But you started to see it. You look back and you see, oh, this is what they were talking about at various points. Most notably, Harry Reid sent a letter, an open letter, to the director of the FBI in October saying, I know that you have explosive damaging allegations against Donald Trump in your possession. Please tell me more. I mean, and it was obviously shadow boxing around this document. And I think, it's pretty remarkable that during a summer when the FBI was talking publicly about its investigation of Hillary Clinton, it was also keeping secret a parallel investigation into Donald Trump. But I think a lot of journalists, including us, when we got it, saw it as a really interesting tip. You get a lot of interesting tips. There are a lot of very specific reporting lines in
there. That the dossier itself was merely a tip.
Yeah, and it's certainly not merely, but one of the things it was certainly a tip. You get all sorts of tips, true and false.
Well, I don't understand. In other words, it's a 35-page dossier which describes all kinds of, as is very famous now, hijinks in a hotel room at the Ritz-Carlton in Moscow, but also financial information and a lot of Kremlinology as well. Who told what to whom inside the Kremlin?
Kremlinology is so good that you're like, wait, does anybody have that information?
I got to say, maybe too good, but we'll get to that in a second. So when you first read it, and this is before the election, when you first read the 35-page dossier in all its grimy detail, what did you make of it? Did you believe it?
I mean, I think I saw it as I think a lot of us saw it as, these are interesting claims, and some of them seem gettable. These are claims about things that either happened or did not happen. They're not philosophical claims. They're not claims about people's mental states.
So you're working on this story the way you would with any, as you call it, a tip.
Yeah, we had four really great reporters chasing different elements of it in Washington, in Prague, and other parts of Europe.
Full time.
Yeah, pretty. I mean, they were very focused on it.
Okay. And did they make any progress?
The thing with progress is you want to confirm. I mean, either you've confirmed something, you've knocked it down, and you don't really have progress until that. And so, obviously, we didn't have anything that we felt had nailed it down. I would go back to saying when we first got the dossier, our world editor Miriam Elder had spent years in Moscow, most recently for The Guardian,
a terrific reporter who I know well.
Terrific reporter. Both said there's a lot in here that is, that basically was obviously written by somebody who knew what they were talking about, but there were also little inaccuracies in it.
That gave her pause.
That gave her pause and gave us pause, yes. And in fact,
So January 10th, I'm in my office, and I've got CNN going, and late afternoon, early evening, on comes this report, Jake Tapper, Carl Bernstein, saying that there has been this dossier, a summary of the dossier, was given to both the President of the United States and the then President-elect, Donald Trump, and they were read in on this. So you see this on CNN. You've held off on publishing for weeks, as you say. So quickly you made a decision to then publish, and I want to get your thinking on that, and how were you able to decide so quickly? Because it was really only a matter of minutes later where people are saying, oh my God, BuzzFeed is now posted, or an hour, or so, whatever it was. Tell me about that evening at the offices of BuzzFeed.
Right. I think it had been sort of a hard call of at what point, if ever, do you publish. But and right then we're thinking, well, there's no particular urgency and we're chasing it. But I think we had always, or at least I had always thought, at some point this is a story. This thing is a story. Once both the allegations have been briefed to the president of the president-elect and effectively summarized to the country, that I think I felt immediately that instinctively the right thing to do is then to share the underlying document.
And knowing that other places that you have some respect for, whether it's the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, obviously CNN, did that not give you pause in making your decision?
I mean, I think there are certain kinds of decisions that I've certainly made through my career and that I think a lot of places that grew up in this new ecosystem have, where the fact that older institutions have a reflex that's rooted in their history and their traditions, in this notion that they are the sort of vestigial notion that they probably wouldn't really even say aloud, but that is in their culture, that their job is to keep the gate and to keep information from their audience
but
at certain times.
Not only wouldn't they say it aloud, they would scream and yell at you, and maybe justifiably, because these are places that have published Watergate, Pentagon Papers, Abu Ghraib, whatever it is. These are not places.
These are great journalistic institutions, and 98% of the time, we agree with them. Like, we also do deep, extensive investigations where we take, you know, months or years to show wrongdoing and are patient about it. I think, you know, the notion, it was an unusual situation, an unverified document kicking around with that kind of political battle over it. Like, it's
followed by a briefing.
There aren't tons of precedents for that.
But had CNN not put up its report that night, would you have posted that night?
We would not have posted that night.
So it was a competitive decision or a moral decision or a journalistic decision or a little of all three?
I think a little of all three. I mean, I think but I would say that already we were thinking and talking about at what point is it appropriate to publish.
Okay. Yeah, you did a very interesting thing. You posted the document, but it also came with almost a warning label. And it included this phrase: Americans can make up their own minds about allegations about the president-elect that have circulated at the highest levels of the U.S. government. Explain that to me.
So we wanted to be clear, because obviously the notion of putting particularly really vivid allegations into play, because the thing is, the core allegations, those are very damning allegations, incredibly damning allegations that, frankly, we had not been able to stand up or knock down. So once those allegations had been made to the president and the president-elect and in public by CNN, to me, that becomes a much easier call. I think once the allegation that there is an allegation from a source reported as credible that the president of the United States has been compromised, there almost any detail is preferable to that. Like the notion of I hold in my hand a list of communists, the notion of a secret, mysterious document that has allegations so dark and explosive.
What you're saying is then you might as well print the names of the alleged
communists. I think that once you get halfway out on that allegation, becomes an easy call to come out to the
other side. Let's
acknowledge
one dynamic of this conversation. You are the editor of BuzzFeed, which has a young audience and a very young staff, and it grew up on the internet. It is a child of the internet itself. I'm the editor of The New Yorker, which has been in existence for 90-plus years, and that's called a legacy media in your terms. You and I saw each other the day after this decision. We had dinner, a longstanding invitation from you. We discussed this somewhat. And you put it in terms of generation, that, in other words, that my reflexes as the editor of a certain age for a legacy media are different than your reflexes, that it's a generational thing, and to some extent somebody in my chair, not necessarily me individually, but in my chair or at the Washington Post or the New York Times, wherever it is, they don't quite get it. Explain that.
I wouldn't say that you don't get it, and I also think that reflexes aren't necessarily the most important thing, and I don't want to overstate the difference. I mean, I think there's a difference between reflexes and judgment, reflexes and values. That said, I do think that BuzzFeed and I came up, doing a kind of journalism that was often really fundamentally about saying to the audience, here is the thing under the thing that you're reading about in these very kind of formalistic ways in the great American newspapers. And I think, you know, some of that particularly was around the Iraq War, the sort of blogging culture around the Iraq War, which was very much about saying, you know, you're reading about these intelligence reports that have been digested six times through various layers of the administration, then pre-chewed and fed to a reporter at a major newspaper. And we, as educated random citizens, can actually dig in and analyze this ourselves and come to different conclusions and distrust. I also
But you're
do
not
think
saying
that
you just dump out all your notes and say, you know, have at it.
I think that you should, when you can, share as much as you can. I think that, you know, I mean, I get crazy unverified tips to my email inbox.
Why not publish them
And to my public Twitter constantly. If you're interested in random unverified tips, feel free to search my replies.
Right.
I don't think they're doing anybody any harm out there, by the way. I think people understand that you should not take what an egg avatar says, you know, and add any particular truth value to it. I think that there's certainly there's a legitimate and real debate over whether the media of the 1970s and 80s that could really fully exercise that gatekeeper function was better, if that was a better world than the world we live in now. I just think it's indisputable that that is not this world, that the idea that you can keep things behind the gate and that the audience should just trust you is You know, honestly, is something that there are a few institutions, yours among them. I hope the New Yorker audience says, you know what, I trust David Remnick to show me some things, not show me others. I don't think that's a kind of trust that most of us should take for granted.
I certainly don't take it for granted. That's something you work for every day, isn't it? I mean, but what you're getting in a criticism from legacy media editors, journalistic pointy heads, people at Pointer, various public editors, can be summarized in this, that your job is not just to receive a dossier, it's to be verified, contextualized. And your argument, I think, Ben, is that by putting this out and by affixing, in all fairness, putting your warning label that it's not verified and so on, that you're not speeding up the process of getting to the truth, but slowing it down. So Kelly McBride at Pointer says that by throwing this out onto the web, despite the warnings, this is her argument, that in fact it gave Donald Trump the opportunity to say, see, it's all sleaze, it's junk, and then the next time the story is advanced maybe in a different direction that is verified, he's going to be able to say the same thing. How do you approach that argument?
I mean, I think that's a deeply specious argument, and for a few reasons. You know, one is just that you know, this is these are the rules of engagement under which the media spent the last couple of years just getting steamrolled by Donald Trump.
Right.
But the idea that there was a stream of journalism saying, you know, we had just figured out how to report on Donald Trump and have him be forced to engage and react to us, and you guys blew it. I just think that seems unlikely to me, that this was the moment when the media was finally going to figure out how to cover Donald Trump. But that's a matter of, I guess, political prognostication, and her guess is in some ways as good as mine on that. Usually, there's no reason to publish an unverified tip because it's not being briefed to the President of the United States. It's not affecting policy. It's just a claim in the air that you have no reason to act on. And then on the other hand, we did chase it very hard. We did, and we and many, many others.
Which is frustrating not to get it. But again, the argument is, okay, you didn't get it, but try harder. Keep going.
Right. And I think the question of, I do think the question is, how long do you sit on this thing that is being briefed to the president?
Till you get it. That's the argument.
And so you keep secret. Harry Reid saw this. He wrote a letter, but we are going to keep secret from you what that letter is about because, you know, Harry Reid may believe it, but we're not going to tell you. I think the notion that you should keep secret objects that are motivating people's decisions in power just seems indefensible to me.
I take your point. Now, we are now a whole week into this new administration. On day one, the press secretary, Sean Spicer, walks into the briefing room and really explodes to the press corps that somehow they are lying about crowd sizes and that you have this back and forth. And he described this as the most watched inauguration in history. We are off to the races here. As the editor of BuzzFeed, what do you expect? What do you think this is going to bring us in terms of a relationship between the new president and the press, and how should the press behave?
I mean, I think Sean's first statement really boils down to who you're going to believe, me or your lion eyes. Like, that was it. And that's a
old Groucho Marx.
And I think that's a real test. Like, there will be outlets, and I think they are trying to, there's an effort now to create and build a new alternate world of media outlets for whom they will believe Donald Trump, not their lying eyes, and they will attack
people.
And
that includes, in addition to Breitbart, what else?
InfoWars. I read recently that Gateway Pundit is going to have a seat in the White House briefing room.
It is interesting to see, not only in BuzzFeed, headlines in the New York Times saying, telling another lie, Trump says da-da-da, using the word lie in headlines and leads and all the rest. We've gone somewhere new.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's an incredible, I think there ought to be a very high bar to using the word lie because you're speculating about somebody's mental state.
Intention.
Yeah, about their intention, which is a hard thing to know. You have to have really clear evidence that they knew what the reality was, and then they said the opposite. I mean, I think Trump does occasionally clear that bar. Other times, I think he says things that are false, and his motives and what's going on in his mind are a mystery.
So how are you going to go cover the White House in Washington now? Is it any different than covering the Obama administration?
I think that the notion that you primarily cover the administration by getting and printing the words of the spokesman is pretty far gone. I mean, I think that was, I don't know when that started deteriorating, but by the time, you know, I was covering campaigns like 15 years ago, the idea that the White House, that the most fun job in Washington was to be in the White House.
Do you care where the White House press room is? If they move it to the old executive office building, does it matter?
You know, it seems to me that that the administration wants to pick a series of fights with the press and wants to pick ones that will make the press look petty. And fighting over your seats maybe seems like it looks petty, but I do think that you got to think about, okay, what's the next one and the next one after that and the next one after that? And given that they seem not to have accepted this very basic convention that when asked a direct question, you give a truthful answer, I don't really think the press ought to be giving ground on any of the other conventions.
Ben, you're a terrific user of Twitter, and you're very good at it. And I want to know—
So what about you? Do you just lurk?
I just lurk.
But you do lurk.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Is there a David Remnick account where I can go see who you follow?
No, there isn't.
Do you have a secret account?
No.
Or you just sort of look at Twitter. How do you do that?
I look around at who interests me, and that leads to one thing or another. I've never wanted to do it because I knew in my heart that it would just take up too much time. And
right.
That time, what else you got? But I completely confess to, not that I need to confess to it, that I look all the time. I see your stuff, and I see when a big news story is going, I go on Twitter like half the world.
And you search the term? I'm sort of interested in
chaotic.
I feel like there's some
Describing chaos is the difficulty. But
there's some very high-powered Twitter lurkers out there.
How should we cover and think about Donald Trump tweeting? Because God knows I look at that every day.
I mean, you know, as you said, I think, you know, I don't want to pretend that I really know. There are these sort of opposite impulses that are both obviously wrong, one of which is, you know, just you got to devote all your energy to just like echoing and saying what he just tweeted and that
right.
in this kind of fast twitch newswire way.
And then alternately,
that you ignore statements from the President of the United States because of the medium they're made on, which doesn't make sense. Presidents have always sought to make statements in ways that they cannot be engaged or rebutted directly, whether it is a written statement, a speech, and a video from the Oval Office, an address. I mean, it's not like, you know, I hope he will give press conferences and answer questions, but also it's not new that the president would just say stuff.
No, there's a kind of myth that if you somehow ask the question keenly enough, ferociously enough, that suddenly the president or whatever official will just go to pieces and all the truth will come pouring out. And somehow that's real journalism.
Seems to me the Brits can do that. I've never seen an American journalist do that. Once in a while you'll see some interview on the BBC where the interviewer asks the same question 17 times.
But part of it is because it goes on long enough.
Yeah.
Press conference is an orchestrated thing where you don't have
that. And if you look at the good Trump interviews, I feel like Jake Tapper figured this out better than anybody else. The good Trump interviews ask the same question.
You keep banging
a number
away.
Of times in a row, and when he can skip from topic to topic in a press conference, it's a show that he loves and enjoys and can't ever really be pinned down.
Do you think the Kellyanne Conway method of deflection, changing the subject, pretending non-reality is reality and vice versa, Now, by the way, of course, her predecessors have all done it at one time or another, but she seems to violate the privilege. And do you think this can go on for an unlimited amount of time?
I mean, I think that we're obviously really in uncharted waters, and it's possible. And if you read about authoritarian regimes that just lie all the time mm-hmm. with no consequences, that is obviously a possible world.
Are you fearful of that?
I mean, it's obviously a pretty scary moment. The tradition of American presidencies is that they, not to this degree and in this extreme way, but always come in with a bunch of stories about how they are, A, popular, which Trump is not, but B, have learned some new trick to go around the media. With Bush, it was speaking to local news, going over the filter was the term he
right.
used. With Obama, it was social media, it was the web, it was
Clinton,
talking to
Clinton
favorite outlets.
Clinton did it as well.
Clinton did it. And it works until reality intervenes and suddenly there is, you know, gasoline spurting out of a pipe in the Gulf of Mexico and all the cameras are pointed at that pipe. And you can say that's not really important. It's not that much gasoline. It doesn't exist. Please point your cameras back toward me.
Mm.
But it doesn't work. And that there's an illusion in the White House that you can control the story, and for each president, there's a moment when that illusion totally shatters. I mean, I think the VA is another good example. I think the Bush administration you know, inherited, made this horrible crisis at the VA, and I think felt, you know, not totally unreasonably, my God, can we focus on something else? And the answer was no, we can't. You're president.
Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
Ben Smith has been the editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed since 2012. I spoke with him just a few days ago, but in that time, new details, and they're coming all the time, new details have surfaced about the dossier and its sources. You can find some of the latest reports at newyorkerradio.org. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's much more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. You need to watch about only 45 seconds of any pro football game before you realize that can't be good for you at all. There have been plenty of spectacular injuries on the field, even deaths, but the invisible damage, the damage from getting your head walloped with huge force repeatedly, that has just recently become known to science, leading to what's been called football's concussion crisis. Nicholas Schmidl has been reporting on ways to make the game safer in light of that crisis. Now, Nick, just give me a reprise on what we know about the damage from concussions and how do we know it?
Yeah, about 15 years ago, a couple of former NFL players committed suicide. And a neuropathologist by the name of Bennett Amalu performed the autopsies on these two individuals as well as one other former player who had recently died. And Amalu discovered on each of their brains, high concentrations of an abnormal protein known as tau. Tau typically presented in Alzheimer's patients. And so he was struck that this was afflicting relatively healthy, middle-aged former professional athletes. And Amalu published his findings. They were not well received by the NFL. And for several years, the NFL denied that there was any connection between playing football and brain damage. In 2011, a number of former NFL players sued the league, alleging that it had deceived them as to the health risks of the game. And the NFL recently settled with the players for just shy of $1 billion.
This has led, or at least it's a major factor, in a dip in participation in football. There are at least 20% fewer boys playing football now in 2009. Nicholas Schmidl spent some time back in the fall at a high school in Florida, St. Thomas Aquinas, that's spending a lot of money trying to make the game safer.
St. Thomas Aquinas is a private high school in Fort Lauderdale with students walking around in docksiders, parents picking up children in BMWs and such. It is not a school with a shortage of resources. It also has a nationally competitive football team. The reason why I went to St. Thomas is that as a result of the NFL's own concussion crisis, the coaches and the athletic director at St. Thomas are taking concerted steps to play the game safer. The other dynamic that appealed to me and that I was intrigued by was that several parents of active players were themselves former NFL players. Last November, on one weekday after practice, I went out to dinner with one of the players, a defensive end named Kevon Bennett, and his father, Cornelius Bennett, who was a NFL legend, Hall of Fame nominee. And we met at a steakhouse in Fort Lauderdale.
You can just leave that on the table, the pitcher? Yeah, you can just leave the water pitcher on the table,
I'll probably drink 7-8 glasses of water.
Cornelius Bennett was a legend in the NFL. He played 13 seasons, went to 5 Super Bowls. He played outside linebacker and was ridiculously fast, incredibly tenacious.
Cornelius Bennett leaping up and volleyballing into the turf.
Like his dad, Cornelius, Kevon Bennett is a fierce defensive player. He plays defensive end for St. Thomas Aquinas.
And again, he runs into Bennett. Number 95 gets his big paws around Javonte Smith. Really like this player. First time I watched.
Kevon, you're just coming back from practice today, yes?
Right.
This is your first week as captain.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
How did that come about?
I think that just came about, you know, just being a natural leader in school, on the field, trying to make sure we always stay as a brotherhood. You know, I think that's an important value that my dad and all my coaches throughout the years have instilled in me. So,
do you have any particular stories from growing up?
First practice of Little League football, my dad told me, I want you to be in front of the line when y'all are doing sprints. He always wanted me to be the head of the team because that's what he did when he was playing in the league and in college and throughout his life as well.
What I did was I stayed out of the way with football. Stayed outside the fence and watched him practice, and I would give him pointers riding home from practice or what have you. But I've always tried to stay out of the way, but I wanted it to be his decision because it's a tough sport, and it's not for everybody. And there was a point in time when Kevon didn't want to play football at all, and I was cool with it. I mean, I feel as though development that Kevon has had over the last 2 years has been phenomenal. He's gone from unheard of to where he is today, and it's attributed to his willingness to go out and work, and he has listened to me over the years, which makes me proud. Yeah. I see him as being as good as he want to be.
Despite having this sterling professional career, arguably one of the highlights of Cornelius Bennett's football career overall is a tackle that he made as a college player. In October of 1986, his school, Alabama, hosted Notre Dame. And Notre Dame had won the previous 4 contests. In the first quarter, Notre Dame's quarterback, Steve Berline, drops back to pass. Just as Berline was looking downfield to find a wide receiver, Bennett comes off the end, running at full speed. Berline has no idea he's coming, and Bennett just drives his shoulder into him, lifts him off the ground, and leaves him on his back.
Career at Notre Dame. Play action, and boom, down he goes! Cornelius Bennett! Loose ball, no, the turf cross the fumble. Oh my goodness, did Cornelius Bennett bury him at the 25-yard line. Berline never saw Cornelius Bennett.
Could you talk about the Berline hit?
Wow. It was the only time in my 20, however many years of playing football that I actually knew that I'd hurt somebody. Not intentionally, of course, because I could hear when I hit him, the air going out of him. You know, almost like, you know, when you puncture something and you just shh. I mean, it was just like that. And so, I mean, I saw him as he was turning around, as he was almost getting the ball up. And I just, you know, was in him before. I mean, that's the only way I can describe it. He was there, and he just happened to meet that speeding train. He happened to be standing on the railroad track. He tried to go with the next play, but I think he eventually fell from under the center. And I think, you know, they eventually called a timeout and got him out of the game.
But Berline was concussed, and I mean, you all then broke Notre Dame's streak of beating Alabama. Mm-hmm. You went into the NFL, retired in 2000. For you, retirement life was great. You golfed, enjoyed.
Did whatever I want to do.
For some of your contemporaries, however, we're having a little bit of a hard time of it. Can you talk about sort of the point that you realized that there were people of your generation that were suffering from some effects of the game?
Well, when you say, so I would assume you're talking about brain injuries or what have you.
Yeah.
Wow, you know, you just, I mean, these are things that have been going on behind closed doors with the union, and we knew that there was some cause and effect. But the owners kept it to themselves and what have you, and hence the $1 billion concussion settlement.
Do you recall specific concussions of your own?
There's one in particular that I know, looking at it now. We were playing Pittsburgh in the early 90s in Buffalo, and I took a heel to the side of the head. But, of course, it happened on more occasions than that. I think in my medical file, probably 6 listed, but that's more.
Would you think that 12, 15 would be a...
More than that.
More than that.
Of course. I played for a long time.
So when Cornelius retired, is right around the time that the concussion crisis was becoming news. And he wanted to use his own street cred, his own reputation, to get involved in trying to change the game for future generations. He had a son who was 7 or 8 years old and asking his dad if he could play football. And so Cornelius becomes involved in the negotiations between the Players Association and league owners in trying to change the rules, trying to essentially make the game safer for his kid and other children of his age.
What do you think have been the most significant, for better or worse, rule changes that have really changed the game?
To me, just the lessening of contact in practice. I mean, that's huge. That ain't no ifs, ands, and buts. I mean, when I played, you hit every day, and you had 2-a-days every day. How many days can y'all hit?
2 days. Yeah. If you think about it, practice, you have... In my case, in high school, we play on Fridays, so we'll have 4 days of practice. And it's what you do in those 4 days that determines how healthy you're going to end up being for the Friday night. If you hit in all those 4 days, you might be a little banged up, and you're going to think, I'm going to still go out there and play. And then on the Friday, it just gets to the point where your body just can't handle it, and it turns out to be, God forbid, something serious.
The days nobody see. Sundays, the targeting stuff, that's probably the biggest.
What Cornelius means here is that on game day, the most important rule change concerns targeting, which covers a variety of illegal forms of contact, including blindsiding unsuspecting players.
You said a hit on Burline. If I'd hit that hit like that today, I'd have been ejected. Ain't no ifs, ands, and buts.
Have you had any dings, concussions that you've...
I've been great with the head injuries. You know, I think that's just a part of the technique they teach us, and also how they keep our practices like full speed but as light, full contact as possible.
I was actually talking to one of the St. Thomas coaches this afternoon, and he was sort of grumbling about the rule changes and saying, you know, like as a former safety, this is not the game that I was playing. A wide receiver should be scared coming across the middle of the field because he's worried about getting hit. Now there's such protections to defend the skill players, the wide receivers, the quarterbacks, et cetera, that it's changing the game.
I do think, you know, I'm an old defensive player. Yeah, I don't want nobody crossing my face, and I can't lay the wood on them. Laying a good lick on a guy in the football field is kind of part of what the game is all about.
Were there things that you were trying to show Kevon when he was 9, 10, 11 about how to protect himself playing the game? Do you remember?
When I sat there on the fence, I tried to, you know, hey, the bull in the ring, the stuff I did when I was a kid. Hey, man, that stuff is outdated.
The bull in the ring, can you describe what does that drill look like?
That's one guy in the middle, circle of guys. And a coach give everybody in the circle a number. So he'd say one Chargers, boom, you take him on. You know, 10, boom, 5, boom. And you know, until the coach get tired of you getting hit. I mean, stupid stuff, you know. It ain't trying to make you tough kind of thing or whatever. That was still stupid.
Dumb. Asinine. It's asinine. It's just dumb. Like,
do you think about head injuries?
I just think about going out, playing, doing my job, winning. That's the only thing I think about in the play.
That's the old school. You know, you don't go out there thinking about them, but doing your best.
Does the game seem safer now than it did when you played it? Or is football just, frankly, a dangerous game that can never sort of...
It's safer because of the new rules, and the high school associations are going to have to make provisions for that. God forbid, I don't ever want to see football go away, man. It's something I love to watch, my son and other kids. More than I like watching the NFL. My dad was a steelworker, and I think if he'd have known about asbestos and other stuff that dealt with in that steel mill, knowing that he had to provide for his family, I don't think it would have changed his mind about working in the steel mill. And that same thing with us in football. I don't have no regrets. All I've tried to do over the years is try to make it a better, safer game.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, people that don't play football and haven't played football at a high level, their opinions are going to be different from those of us that are going to end up playing football at a high level. So, but football is still football. People are going to be diehard fans for years to come.
That's Kevon Bennett, and we heard his father, Cornelius Bennett, who retired from the Indianapolis Colts in 2000. They talk with the New Yorker's Nicholas Schmidl, who wrote about the use of safety measures by Kevon's high school team, including some very expensive tackling robots. You can find that article at newyorkerradio.org. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hey, Adam, how are you?
Hi, David. Good to be here.
Adam Davidson joined the New Yorker just a few months ago, and we've been working him like crazy. He's written about economics and business, not to mention Donald Trump's conflicts of interest. So, Adam, this has been just your average week. We had the inauguration and a very kind of soulful, subtle inaugural speech followed by...
Yes, a continuity. Yeah.
An incredibly crazy series of events, and it promises, I don't know, untold tumult in days and weeks and maybe years to come. How do you get through it?
I mean, as a reporter, I can't think of any time. You covered the fall of the Soviet Union. I would guess that came close to this kind of work.
But can I be honest?
Yeah.
That wasn't my country. Yeah. I was the visitor. I was from the outside looking in, even though I was living there. This is different.
This is different. You know, and I, like many people here at The New Yorker, are working on some bigger substantive stories that take a big view of who this man, President Trump, is. And what it means is all day, every day, we are in reaction mode. And I'm talking about Trump, I'm thinking about Trump, I'm reading about Trump, I'm writing about Trump, and it is overwhelming.
So, but what's necessary here, if you're going to live a life, is to get relief from it. And so your three ways of doing so are?
Number one is the Funny or Die TV series, now on Hulu, Billy on the Street.
Yeah.
Have you seen Billy on the Street?
Pretty damn good.
So Billy Eichner is a stand-up comedian who, years ago, before anyone outside of a very small world had heard of him, used to do on his own very lo-fi video interviews on the street. He'd do a stand-up bit in a New York theater and play these videos. And eventually, they became a TV show produced by Funny or Die, and now he has his own show. A different show that I also like called Difficult People on Hulu. But Billy on the Street, to me, it is the perfect escape from the news today because Billy Eichner runs around the streets of New York with a camera crew screaming at strangers on the street, just yelling questions at them, demanding that they participate in these.
Sounds like my morning commute.
It sounds like your morning commute, exactly. It's how you run this magazine, running around screaming at us.
Miss, for a dollar. For a dollar, you can win a dollar. True or false? If you put a black wig on Jane Lynch, she'd look more like Chris Noth than you'd think. True or false?
True
or false? True or false? Yes, you win here! Go buy yourself a piece of fruit.
I'll do more for the I'm going to wait and see what I really want.
Oh.
I'm just not going to, you know, spend it on
a piece of fruit.
I mean, you know.
A piece of f***ing fruit.
Well, what does that mean?
What do you mean? I mean, I'm talking about a piece of f***ing fruit.
A piece of f***ing fruit?
I actually like it a bit less as he got more famous and he brings on celebrities. Those are fun too, but the idea of just a weird, crazy Jewish guy running around New York screaming at people on the street in a very funny way was very fun.
But in fairness, it sounds like a third of the population in my neighborhood, but nevertheless, what's your number two?
My number two is a CIA spy novel series by the former New York Times reporter Alex Berenson, who I didn't know well, but I knew a little bit in Baghdad. We both were reporters there. And I've never been one for these spy novels, but this one has been great for the last few weeks. It's really seen me through. It's what I read at night as I'm trying to just close out the day. I don't want the frantic Billy Eichner. I just want something to read.
Sounds like heaven.
And it's, I mean, granted, like all spy novels, the plots are absurd, but it is written by a reporter who actually, I think the books have done well enough that he, the first one was written about places he had traveled to as a New York Times reporter. But now my sense is, I don't know for sure, is he makes enough money that he actually goes to the places. So if there's a description of Cape Town, South Africa, it has that kind of reportorial richness that that comes from someone having actually been on the street. And so it's what I've learned about my escapist literature cravings is that I'm fine with a ridiculous plot where there's some superhero who doesn't die even though he should have died 500 times before and who solves the world every other week, as long as the base narrative is really factually accurate. And there's 10 of them. The 10th comes out next week. I'm halfway through the 9th. I'm just hoping to time it so that there's not a night where I don't have Alex Berenson to read. But I don't know what they're called because they all have the same, all those spy novels, you know, A Mystery at Night, Flying Through the Eagles, whatever.
Knife of Dawn.
Knife of Dawn. Alex Berenson, John Wells is the hero. You can look it up. The third one is actually, for me, is a true piece of literature, and it's Bruce Springsteen's autobiography, Born to Run. I mean, I'm a lifelong, profound Bruce Springsteen fan, but it is more than just, you know, the self-indulgent memoirs of a pop star. There's something.
Did you read it or listen to it?
I listened to it.
How was that?
It was amazing.
And it's
him.
It.
It's him reading it, and it's read beautifully. And for me, anyway, there's something about a man nearing 70 who is both raw and honest, but also incredibly forgiving for himself and his father and other people in his life when he was a young, angry, furious man. It helps me imagine one day being close to 70, looking back at this time and hopefully having some perspective, some generosity, as well as some stark truth to it.
The New Yorker's Adam Davidson. There's more coming up, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. And this is Scirocco Dunlap stressing over how to draft the perfect text message.
Okay, do I wait for him to text? Okay. Okay. I had so much fun last night. You're great. Oh, boy. No. Okay. I had so much fun last night. You're great. I'm an alien. Okay, no. Hey, last night was great. I'm an alien trying to aid in humanity's demise. Oh, I got tics to Ed Sheeran. You like him, right? I know that because I can read your mind. No, okay. I hope I'm not coming on too strong, but I honestly feel like I could fall for you. I have a second layer of skin that puckers during the act of mating in a way I think you'll find attractive. Do you like karaoke? No one likes karaoke. Okay. Are you DTF? By which I mean down to fulfill the destiny of humankind by disintegrating tomorrow at midnight when we activate the laser beams. We'll just start right over. Thinking about you and you're thinking about how you didn't cry when your grandmother died, but you did cry when your internet went out in the middle of an episode of Nashville. I have got to stop reading your mind. Oh, look, I'm extremely sensitive and scared to tell you how much I like you. But here goes. I like you. Wow, that feels great. I'm gonna try to download your brain before the ray guns obliterate you. It's 2 a.m. What up?
Scirocco Dunlap's Drafting the Perfect Text. You can find all her work for The New Yorker, most of it far too weird to put on the radio, at newyorkerradio.org. We're going to close up today after we spend a little quality time with another comic genius of The New Yorker, cartoonist Liana Fink. Her work has a kind of gentle absurdism, a silly side, but also a very sharply observed sense of human nature. About once a week, Liana Fink takes a long trip on the Long Island Railroad, which goes into the suburbs and the rural counties east of New York City.
I like to come up with New Yorker cartoons on the train. It's good because I don't have a fixed workspace, so I started working in fancy cafes, and those are wonderful, but they are obnoxious. Like, people are always eyeing your table because they want to sit at it. I can't stand when people talk to me when I'm working, but I love when they talk to each other. I don't like to be in a vacuum when I'm drawing. I think my ideal would really be to be a ghost and get to be around people all the time.
Number 4, please.
A train is better because people are mostly facing the same way. No one's going to look you in the eye.
Change in Babylon.
It's after sunrise, but not very long after, and the sky is grayish and cloudy, and there's a 7-Eleven and an auto body shop and a lot of cars, and it's a type of bleak that I like. It's maybe suburban sprawl.
Freeport Station, America's Next, this is Freeport.
I'm always mean to start coming up with cartoons on the train, but sometimes I just send emails and look out the window. But I start to feel free in a certain way. I think one of the nice things about the train is that I can't really do like perfectly finished work on it. I can't make a finished cartoon. I have to just come up with ideas. And I think like my favorite thing to do is just to think and to play and on the train, I'm forced to just think and doodle.
Station is Lindenberg, Babylon is next.
We're transferring at Babylon. We just got onto a fancier train with higher headrests and two stories and a bathroom. I printed out an old batch of New Yorker cartoons that I liked a lot that didn't sell, even though I thought they were really good that time. And I'm going to look at them and see if I can make them clearer, and maybe this time they'll sell. So this one is a pine tree with an air freshener dangling from it that is shaped like a car. That's good. I don't need to fix that one up. This is a hall of statues. Oh, I guess they're busts on pillars. That says hall of life-size Pez dispensers. This one doesn't bring me joy anymore. I don't think it's funny anymore. I don't think it ever was. This one is interesting. I think this one brings me joy. It says pigeon nest, and it's a nest on a tree that's made of garbage. I love pigeons, and I think I need to think more about, like, maybe the reason this isn't a good cartoon yet is that it's on a tree. Maybe a pigeon nest isn't on a tree. Like, I'll think about that. Oh, here's a stupid one. It's a bird inside a gator's mouth, and the bird is saying, "Do you even floss?" I have really good dental hygiene. Birds are like the dentist's patron animal because they do clean the mouths of some kind of gator, ala or kraka. The gator does not look anatomically correct. I once saw an iguana that got loose from its container on a train, and it was just walking like really slowly down the train aisle, and then its owner didn't realize that it had escaped, and everyone's just kind of like, what's that? It was really big. It's getting really beautiful outside. There's a pond out the window with those things that look like wheat coming out of it. The houses they look like a fisherman might live in them. It looks like the town has been this way for a long time. I love that it doesn't look brand new. It's funny, like, I don't think I'm telling you accurate stuff about what I think about on the train, because my drawing self, I think, is one self, and my talking self is another self, and I just, like, can't access the drawing self when I'm talking. My drawing self is smart and savvy and knows exactly what she's doing, and my talking self is kind of a human impersonator. Like, in my drawing, I feel like I can be anyone. Like, I can channel all kinds of personalities and thoughts, and I don't tell myself what to draw. It just comes out. When I'm in the city, I feel like my social self, which isn't exactly my real self, is just on high alert, and she's always expecting someone to talk to her. But on the train, you have no choices, and no one's going to talk to you. And I get to just, like, put her on a shelf a bit more, and then ideas come out. The drawing self gets to be alive again. It's almost time for us to get off. I always wish that I had a lot longer, and that's a nice feeling.
Liana Fink on the Long Island Railroad. We've got some of her work up at newyorkerradio.org, and you can find the whole hour there as well. I'm David Remnick, and this has been the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks so much for joining me today. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.